This is April 24th, 2016, and I'm going to talk today about action, busyness, and what is beyond action and busyness. This was prompted by having come across an article in a local magazine called The Post. This was the November-December issue of 2015. And it's called The Glorification of Busy. It's by Mary Stone. The lead is Americans schedule time. We try to beat it by accomplishing more than we thought we could. But what is this perception, this need to conquer every minute of every day, doing to our health? I'll just start off from the beginning of this article. She writes, "When I was living in Paris many moons ago, my now ex-husband and I rode the train to Versailles every Sunday for dinner with his family. During the apéritif, usually sipped in the garden or sitting room, my then mother-in-law would turn to me and ask, 'What beautiful thing did you do this week?' It's a common expression in France, which in English would be more like, 'How did you enjoy your time?' But to an American like me, the question seemed abstract. All I could think of was work, or what I had to get done at home. Nothing beautiful. Like many of my compatriots, our weeks and days are measured by what we accomplish, not what we enjoy. My mother-in-law, by contrast, would recount a rhapsodic list of beautiful things she had done, aside from her work as a teacher. A hike with a group of friends, an exhibition she had been longing to see, a tour of oft-overlooked treasures at the Louvre, a play she saw with her husband, a lecture on historic architecture she attended. To her, enjoyment was a priority alongside work. She possessed that joie de vivre, an exuberant enjoyment of life, the French are known for, and which, as an American, I had no understanding of at all. Part of that difference might come from a pressure to get things done, which Nazareth professor Mark Weber says Americans create for themselves by procrastinating. The resulting pressure makes us impatient. And then this is him talking. We want results now. We want a text returned immediately. We want sales to grow faster than practicality. We tap our feet waiting, Weber says. Technology impacts this behavior, but it has always been there. In the early 80s, I walked a mile from a beautiful Maine cottage on the ocean to a gas station to pick up voicemails on a payphone. She says that when he was a marketing professor and director of international business at Nazareth College, he is now, he teaches students the cultural differences he observed firsthand as a top executive at Kodak and Heidelberg Printing. He went on 120 international trips, managing their divisions and negotiating contracts with locals. Compared to other cultures like the French, Americans do not stop to smell the roses, Weber says. That is not to say, however, that we don't have fun. And then these are his words. We are relative risk takers compared to the rest of the globe. We also tend to procrastinate more than others. This is news to me. I didn't know that as far as a broad differences among people, cultures. Putting fun before a difficult activity is not unusual. Like my students, before an exam, we are guilty of enjoying the day and working all night to make a deadline, Weber says. By contrast, he says, the French get their work done and enjoy the weekends, the vacations, and holidays with less stress and worries. Paradoxically, Americans put great value on time. For us, time equals money. Weber says, think how a CEO deals with Wall Street investors who want immediate returns. A linear approach to time, a need to divide it up and treat it as tangible, is mainly a result of cultural conditioning. Culturally embedded, mainly subconscious patterns that influence our perception and ultimately how we live our lives. A Zen word for this would be our collective karma, our collective conditioning or habit forces that we share as a people. Anthropologists and social psychologists refer to the way cultures view time as chronemics. Chronemics is how we value time and react to it, which can vary significantly between countries. The concept was developed in the 1990s by American anthropologist and cultural researcher Edward T. Hall. Hall charted how cultures' views of time affect their lifestyle, how they spend their days, how fast they move, even how fast they speak, and also how willing they are to listen to each other. In Hall's terms, France, like most Latin countries, is considered polychronic, meaning, among other characteristics, they are more spontaneous and flexible with their time. By contrast, the United States and other countries with their roots in industrialization and Protestantism are monochronic. Working hard is part of a noble life in Protestant cultures. In Catholicism, it doesn't so much figure in. Something just comes to mind as I'm reading that. I think in Buddhist countries, the traditional Buddhist countries, it's more diverse than this. They're the Southeast Asian Buddhist countries, which would, I think, by these measures, would be more polychronic, more flexible and relaxed about time. The Japanese, from everything I've heard and seen while I was there, they're like the ultimate in the monochronic. I've read several studies about vacation time that the Japanese are the only people who take less vacation time than Americans do. And then maybe the Chinese and the Koreans are maybe a little in between the Southeast Asian countries and the Japanese. Of course, China is such a huge country, it can be quite a range of different styles within China, southern China and northern. He continues, or she does, no, she's quoting him, predominantly Protestant countries such as the United Kingdom, Germany, Switzerland, Canada, and Scandinavia, anthropologists call monochromic. I think that's a typo, monochronic, like much of the United States. Monochronics like us to strive to be punctual, to avoid interruptions. Germans are even more so. Anthropologists find Germans can tolerate only so much uncertainty, Weber says. To limit uncertainty, they abide strictly by rules and schedules, while polychronic countries, such as Italy, Greece, Spain, France, and many Latin American and Arab cultures are more apt to value relationships more than schedules and time limitations. This, by the way, was a great revelation for me when I realized, living in Mexico, why it is a fair generalization that Mexicans, like some of these other culture she refers to, place less value on punctuality. It's because they place more value, relatively speaking, on relationships. So I would heard many instances of someone who was on their way, who would be on their way to a business meeting, let's say, and they'd run into their cousin on the street who they hadn't seen in a month or a day. And of course, catching up with that cousin would be more important to them than arriving on time. This is a revelation because it helped me be less judgmental about the lateness on the part of our Sangha members in Mexico. We still had set the rules. You know, you got to be here by 7 o'clock or whatever, and we had to try to enforce those. But that cultural tendency to be late could understand it in a more balanced way. That who's to say that relationships are cultivating relationships is in some fundamental way less deserving of our time than being on time for a meeting. It's like so many things. If we can understand what's behind the differences of other people, individuals, or cultures, if we just can understand what it's coming from, then it can is an antidote to judging them. Still, within any culture, there are standards, there are expectations that you defy at your own risk. And so we're not saying that the United States and Germany and Northern European countries should change to be like those other countries, just that let's understand this phenomenon better and see how we can balance it, find more balance in these things. But to pick up what she was saying about these more southern countries are more apt to value relationships more than schedules and time limitations. They think about what is to be achieved, while monochronic cultures like us tend to think about when something has to be achieved. Hall's models showed. The result is a sense of pressure that seems to exist to greater degrees in monochronic countries. And then the author goes into a very interesting stretch of paragraphs about time and sleep cycles and individual differences that I have to skip, and then pick up with her having talked with a John Engels, local guy. He's president of a company called Leadership Coaching. That's a leadership consulting company here. Engels says he sees unprecedented levels of busyness, which he thinks stems from a flight from intimacy and mortality. This is really, I think, the crux of this article from a Dharma perspective, is what makes us flee into busyness when it's not called for. Of course, there are times when we have to meet deadlines. That's true in southern countries as well, but the point of the article is that Americans tend to do this compulsively. A flight from intimacy and mortality. He says, as long as we're busy, 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 we don't have to deal with the fact that we're finite, that we're going to be stopped at some point, that we're not going to be able to do everything we want to do, that we're not going to be able to have everything our way, we're not going to have zero defects. The author continues, chronic busyness can be like any other addiction, a means of relieving anxiety from these fears, he says. But in business, that only adds to the already existing level of risk. And then, quoting him, the net result of all this busyness is people aren't thinking and basing decisions on emotional impulses. There's nothing more irresponsible than a leader who doesn't have time to think. It's the same with parents. I think there's a typo here when it says the net result of all this busyness is people. Yeah, okay, people aren't thinking, and instead, that's the word that makes this more clear. They aren't thinking, and instead they're basing the decisions on emotional impulses. There's nothing more irresponsible than a leader who doesn't have time to think. Well, thinking has its place, but the more important thing is to get beyond thinking. If you have the time, to make the time to allow thoughts to settle through either formal sitting or in some other way, using the mind to go beyond the commotion in the mind, and in that way to get a broader or deeper perspective on one's life. This is the value of Zen practice. I'm sure that if this John Engels, I think he may have come to a workshop, I'm not sure. I think that's what he really means when he says think. It's to reflect. It's to stop just driving oneself and let things be for a while. Hit the pause button. This is an absolutely indispensable aspect of a conscious life. We have to make time. And we do. We make time. We create time when we have the ability to stop. What happens is that when we sit, let's just talk about sitting for the moment, when we sit and allow thoughts to settle, then we see things in a fresh way. We see connections more clearly. It's even good for problem solving, because something emerges that is more intelligent than even the most brilliant intellect. It's the quality of our lives that we can change through practice. And what is more important than that? Not just for our own sake, but for what we have to give to others. So just a couple more paragraphs. When we don't have time to think, we don't have time for ideas, for innovation, he says. The moment of illumination of a great idea is during relaxation, Engels says. High-pressure environments generally don't produce great ideas. And yet, this doesn't mean we have to retire from the world and take the most simple kind of jobs we can find. We can, through mature Zen practice, we can find the space in the midst of even a very busy job. We can do this. We can bring that stillness into activity. We learn it. We learn how to do that. It makes a difference. We can't base job decisions on purely external circumstances. We have this great capacity to change our experience of the job and not be bound by the nature of the job. And then he finally says, as long as we're busy, we don't have to stop to relate to people, he says. We don't have time to really get to know someone on an emotional level that is meaningful and substantial. Life is such now that we don't have time for that anymore. We've got other things to do, Engels says. It's so automatic that we're actually busy when we have nothing to do. This article reminded me of an excellent book that I read many years ago called The Active Life by Parker Palmer. The subtitle of this book is A Spirituality of Work, Creativity, and Caring. This Parker Palmer, I think he's a Quaker, but on the back of the book it just says that he's a highly respected writer, lecturer, teacher, and activist. The Leadership Project, a 1998 survey of 10,000 American educators, named him one of the 30 most influential senior leaders in higher education and one of the 10 key agenda setters of the past decade. And he's written 6 other books and has been recognized with 8 honorary doctorates and several national awards. He holds a PhD from University of California at Berkeley and lives in Madison, Wisconsin. Well, at the time of this book, anyway. I went back and fished this book out of my shelves and found this kind of a poem, a prose poem by Xuanzi. This is from a chapter in the book that has the same as it's the same as the title. It's called The Active Life. Xuanzi was a 4th century B.C. Chinese Taoist teacher. Those are the two big names that I'm familiar with in Taoism is Xuanzi, Laozi, and Mencius, I guess. So 4th century B.C., it makes him almost a contemporary of the Buddha. And this verse, extended verse called Active Life, was translated. This translation is by Thomas Merton. So Merton, even this was might have been at least 40 years ago, had the intelligence to, in some of these cases, some of these lines, to render he as she. So here's the. The poem by Xuanzi. If an expert does not have some problem to vex him, he is unhappy. If a philosopher's teaching is never attacked, she pines away. If critics have no one on whom to exercise their spite, they are unhappy. All such people are prisoners in the world of objects. He who wants followers seeks political power. She who wants reputation holds an office. The strong man looks for weights to lift. The brave woman looks for an emergency in which she can show bravery. The swordsman wants a battle in which he can swing his sword. People past their prime prefer a dignified retirement in which they may seem profound. People experienced in law seek difficult cases to extend the application of laws. Liturgists and musicians like festivals in which they parade their ceremonious talents. The benevolent, the dutiful, are always looking for chances to display virtue. Where would the gardener be if there were no more weeds? What would become of business without a market of fools? Never know when the laughs are going to come. Where would the masses be if there were no pretext for getting jammed together and making noise? What would become of labor if there were no superfluous objects to be made? Produce, get results, make money, make friends, make changes, or you will die of despair. So this is a reminder that there's something more to doing in this life, and accomplishing and achieving and attaining. There are these words by the great Tibetan Lama Milarepa, I think roughly 7th century. Affairs and business will drag on forever, so lay them down and practice now the Dharma. If you think tomorrow is the time to practice, suddenly you find that life has slipped away. Who can tell when death will come? Of course, in Zen, we want to make our work our practice. Practice is not just sitting. We don't have to become monks and nuns to maintain practice throughout the day. It's hard, but we just get better at it gradually over time. And then there is a bit of text after the poem, and I think this is also by Xuanzi, who explains for us what his point is. Those who are caught in the machinery of power take no joy except in activity and change, the whirring of the machine. Whenever an occasion for action presents itself, they are compelled to act. They cannot help themselves. They are inexorably moved like the machine of which they are a part. Prisoners in the world of objects, they have no choice but to submit to the demands of matter. They are pressed down and crushed by external forces, fashion, the market, events, public opinion. Never in a whole lifetime do they recover their right mind. The active life. What a pity. Before anyone feels compelled to give up their job and become shepherds, this author Parker Palmer explores the deeper meaning of this, and he does it so well. I'm going to read some of what he says and then comment on that. First, he says the problem of action, as Xuanzi means it, is not as modern as we think. So often we excuse our frenzy by attributing it to such 20th century ills as urbanization, technology, mass society, and rapid social change. An analysis that locates the problem, and therefore the solution, outside ourselves. But if Xuanzi was protesting the pathologies of action over 2 millennia ago, there's no reason to believe that even a radical change in social circumstances would return us to sanity. Apparently, we have long carried the problem of action with us, and so the solutions are likely to be with us as well. And then he says, too much of our action is really reaction. This is the gist of this warning of Xuanzi's. that too often what we think of as being active and dynamic and purposeful and all is reacting. Palmer says, such doing, in quotation marks, does not flow from free and independent hearts, but depends on external provocation. It does not come from our sense of who we are and what we want to do, but from our anxious reading of how others define us and of what the world demands. When we react this way, we do not act humanly. We become cogs in a machine whose every move is forced by what is happening elsewhere in the interlocked system of cogs. All such, then quoting Xuanzu again, he says, all such people are prisoners in the world of objects. He says that too many of us, this is the Palmer, the author, too many of us consent or are forced to spend time doing things for which we have no heartfelt reason. If we were asked, why are you doing this, we would not know how to answer. He says, when our action is dictated by factors external to our souls, we do not live active lives, but reactive lives. I remember reading long, long ago, when I was first getting into Zen, a couple books by Eric Fromm, the psychoanalyst who had an interest in Zen. And he made the point that passion, someone who is possessed by a passion, is not free. And he even made the linguistic point that passion comes from the same root word as passive. We're being acted upon. We're in the grip of something. We're not in the driver's seat. Passion is one of these buzzwords. You see it everywhere. You see it on billboards of colleges. There's one that says, passion, we teach it. So it has a positive value to it these days. But too often, it's just reacting. He says he mentions different kinds of situations of being bound by our conditioning on an international scale, nations getting into conflict, in driving a car, reacting to others, road rage. And he says, and ironically, in cases such as these, the actors often claim that they acted to exercise or protect their freedom, even as the knee-jerk nature of their responses proves that they have lost the freedom to act. If they were acting rather than reacting, they would transcend the tight, deterministic logic of their situations. They would escape the reflex response and claim the freedom of authentic action. And here too, this is where meditation comes in, and in the broader sense, not just sitting, but bringing our meditation into our driving, into our interactions with others, it opens a little space where we can choose how to respond. We're not in the grip of action and reaction, which, by the way, is the simplest definition of karma. Karma, at its very simplest, it means action. But more broadly, it means action and reaction, the chain of action and reaction. So long as we are bound by action and reaction, we're not free. And that's where the work of daily sitting enables us in these situations. Let's take driving. It's such a perfect arena for practice, where we have a little space, a split second, where before we react, and where we can choose to how we're going to respond or not respond. There's a koan in the Mumonkan, number 8, Kechu's Carts. It goes like this. Master Getan said to a monk, Kechu, and Kechu was supposedly the first wheel maker in ancient China, Kechu made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. If you took off the wheels and removed the axle, then what would it be? And this is, like all koans, this one requires a demonstration, not an explanation, but a demonstration. And it's a like so many koans, it's a beautiful metaphor that points to truth, the Dharma. The cart points to our true nature. So then what are the wheels, the spokes? And what does he mean? If you took off the wheels and removed the axle, then what would it be? If we freed ourselves from our reactive habits based on thoughts, our conditioning, what would this be? This one. If we could free ourselves from notions, the notions that deeply ingrained, not just little thoughts that flit in out of the mind, but the deeply ingrained habits of the conceptual habits, what then? And then the Palmer says that Chuang Tzu goes beyond the claim that our action is too often reaction. His deeper criticism, This takes it to a different level, is that many of us intentionally seek out those situations that will trigger our favored reactions. And then going back to Chuang Tzu's poem, the strong man looks for weights to lift, the brave woman looks for an emergency, and so forth. And Palmer says, we might add, the nation or person with weapons looks for a chance to use them. The corporation that owns farmland looks for a chance to exploit it. The clerk with rules in hand looks for someone to exclude. Chuang Tzu is describing the actor as addict, totally dependent on situations that trigger a certain response. However noble strength and bravery may be, it is ignoble to seek excuses to flaunt them. When we do so, we reveal that strength and bravery are not our true nature, but merely public postures. He continues, the people in Chuang Tzu's poem have no self-sustaining identity. They are wholly defined by the settings and relationships of the world of action. They equate selfhood with particular activities, and their vitality depends on being in places where they can play those roles. Put them in places where their competencies are not required, and they find themselves on the thin edge of non-being. which takes us back to what that magazine article, Mary Stone, or the Engels, the leadership consultant, saying that we flee into activity, compulsive activity, as a way of avoiding intimacy and mortality. We have this sense. It may not be conscious for most people, but there's a sense of if we didn't have things to grasp at, activities or thoughts, who would we be? What? There would be nothing, no one, no self. And this is frightening to most people, even though they don't articulate it in their minds this way. They're not conscious about it. There is this always this fleeing from no thing. From just being, fleeing into doing to escape just pure being. He goes back to, Palmer goes back to the poem where Xuanzi talks about these different occupations, where we be. He says that as professionals, we like to define ourselves in ways that stress competence, high standards, an ethic of service, personal sacrifice, and so on. But in active life, Xuanzi is examining the shadow side of professional activity, and he would probably propose a different definition. A professional is a person who has invested long hours and much money to develop an allegedly rare ability that others can be convinced to need and to purchase at a high price. Admittedly partial, such a definition points to the ways that we professionals get caught in the world of objects, to use Xuanzi's term, in the spinning of those interlocked illusions that too often trap the professional and the society in a vicious circle of nonsense. And then he makes the point that becoming a professional requires an investment of time and money that can easily set the vicious circle in motion. We have a myth in our society that the more education one has, the more choices one can make. True, more education may lead to more affluence and hence to more consumer choices, but more education may also narrow the range of meaningful choices about the directions of our lives. Once you have spent 10 years and a small fortune getting a medical degree, how can you choose to be a logger if you discover that logging is what you really want to do? If we had perfect self-discernment before we began professional training and we got trained in our heart's desires, all would be well. But we lack such prescience. It often takes years for our hearts to speak, and when they do, we often cannot hear them, having been deafened by the system that Xuanzi describes. Well, just to take out this one phrase, if we had perfect self-discernment before we began professional training and we got trained in our heart's desires, all would be well. That's what meditation is at its best. It's learning a system that enables us to become attuned to what our deeper calling is. We can get beneath the noise of these competing demands by parents and friends and others, society in general, and can come into accord first to grasp to see what who we really are and what our what we can bring to the world in this life, and then in doing so, have the faith and the sureness to pursue that instead of getting snagged into something that we don't really, it doesn't really speak to us. I think it's one of the great things about this country is that I think more than in other countries, there is this willingness to change course if we find that what we've chosen as a career isn't working out, isn't really speaking to us, then we see this. I think we see it more than we used to, certainly more than in the 50s and the 60s, where people are willing to stop their career and go into something entirely different. It's very, very admirable and smart, intelligent. We want to be living in accordance with our natural abilities and what our heart is calling for us to do. I'll just finish by reading the verse to this koan, Kechu's Carts. When a wheel spins rapidly, even a master cannot follow it. It moves in all directions, above and below, north, south, east, and west. Ultimately, this movement of engaging with the world in what is the most deeply important natural way for each of us as an individual, this is something that is unfathomable. It doesn't come from doing charts and calculations of lifetime income and so forth. It's beyond that. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gains beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gains beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gains beyond measure.